Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We have a bit of a philosophical cold case on our hands today.
Oh, a cold case. I like that.
Yeah. Well, the setting is the mid-20th century. The location is mostly Oxford and Cambridge. And the victim, oddly enough, was meaning itself.
Meaning with a capital M. It sounds dramatic, I know, but in the history of ideas, it really was a crime scene. Philosophy had backed itself into this very, very tight corner.
Right. We're talking about a specific moment when a group of thinkers, the logical positivists, decided that for a sentence to mean anything at all, it had to be scientifically, empirically verifiable.
Exactly. Like, if you couldn't touch it or measure it or test it in a lab, it wasn't just incorrect, it was nonsense. It was just noise.
And the mission of our deep dive today is to explore the rebellion against that rigid worldview. So we are looking at the rise of what's called ordinary language philosophy.
Which is a massive shift. It involves heavyweights like Ludwig Wittgenstein, Gilbert Ryle, J.L. Austin.
And their whole counter-argument was that language isn't just some label maker for scientific facts. It's a toolbox, a vast toolbox.
And by establishing that, they essentially rescued ethics, religion, and metaphysics from the trash heap of meaninglessness. Which is huge for you listening to this because it completely changes how we are allowed to talk about human experience.
It does. But before we get to the rescue mission, we kind of have to understand the captors, right? Mm-hmm. We need to set the stage with the positivist view.
Right. The early Wittgenstein, Bertrand Russell, and especially A.J. Eyre.
Yes. We have to ask, what was their vision of a perfect language? Because they really wanted an ideal language.
From what I gathered in the source material, they wanted something akin to symbolic logic. Or pure mathematics, a system totally free of loose connotations, where every single symbol is defined by a specific empirical reference point.
Precisely. They wanted to clean up philosophy once and for all, because they looked at centuries of debates about the soul and God and the good, and they just saw it all as messy, unverifiable.
So A.J. Eyre drops the hammer in his book, Language, Truth, and Logic.
He really did.
He argued that a statement like God exists isn't true, but it also isn't false.
And that is the concept that usually trips people up. Because how can a claim be neither true nor false?
Well, truth and falsehood in that positivist framework only apply to factual claims about the physical world.
Right. And Eyre argued that since God is not a sense object, like you can't see, touch, or measure a metaphysical being, the term has zero empirical reference.
So therefore, the sentence God exists is devoid of factual meaning.
To Eyre, saying God exists is linguistically identical to saying the flibber-flabber is glupus.
Just absolute gibberish.
Exactly. It has grammatical structure, sure, but zero content. And this cut both ways, which is actually really important to remember. It meant atheism was meaningless, too.
Oh, because you can't meaningfully deny the existence of something that is linguistically meaningless to talk about in the first place.
You got it. Eyre thought he had essentially solved the conflict between science and religion by saying science asserts facts and religion asserts nothing. It just expresses emotion.
Which is incredibly dismissive. I mean, even if it's logically consistent within his very narrow framework.
Uniquely dismissive.
But this leads us to the rebellion. And the sources highlight a specific turning point here. There was a debate called theology and falsification.
Yes, this is really the narrative core of what we're talking about today. It was a discussion at a university involving three philosophers, Antony Flew, R.M. Hare, and Basil Mitchell.
And they used three distinct parables to try and figure out what religious language is actually doing if it's not just stating simple scientific facts.
I love that they use stories to argue high-level logic.
Same. Let's unpack the first one. This is Antony Flew and the Invisible Gardener.
Okay, so picture two explorers. They stumble upon a clearing in a jungle. There are flowers and weeds, but the plot looks tended. It has order.
Okay.
One explorer says, there must be a gardener here. But the other explorer disagrees.
So they decide to test it. They set a watch to see if a gardener shows up.
They do. But they never see anyone. So the believing explorer says, well, perhaps he's an invisible gardener.
Moving the goalposts.
Exactly. So they escalate the test. They set up barbed wire, electrified fences. They bring in bloodhounds.
The whole nine yards.
But there's never a shriek, never a movement on the wire. And the dogs never bark.
And yet the believer still doesn't concede.
No, the believer says, but there is a gardener. Invisible, intangible, immune to electric shocks. A gardener who has no scent and makes no sound, who comes secretly to look after the garden.
At which point the skeptic asks the critical question, how is an invisible, intangible, undetectable gardener different from no gardener at all?
Right. Flew's point is about falsification. He's challenging the believer. He's asking, what would have to happen? What evidence could possibly arrive that would make you admit you were wrong?
It's the death by a thousand qualifications. If you keep moving the goalposts every time the evidence fails, are you actually making a claim anymore?
Exactly. Because if your claim prohibits nothing, it asserts nothing. If the statement God exists is compatible with literally any state of affairs, war, peace, plague, health, then it doesn't tell us anything about the world. That was Flew's challenge.
So that's the attack. But then R.M. Hare steps in. And he agrees that religious language doesn't behave like scientific hypothesis testing, but he completely disagrees that it's meaningless.
Right.
He tells the parable of the paranoid Don, Don being a university professor here.
Yes. So this professor is convinced, absolutely certain, that all the other professors want to murder him.
A fixed delusion.
A total delusion.
Yeah.
His friends introduce him to the mildest, kindest professors imaginable. They say, look, he didn't try to kill you. He offered you tea.
And the paranoid professor says, don't you see? He was just pretending to be nice to lull me into a false sense of security so he can strike later.
So just like the invisible gardener, no amount of evidence can convince him otherwise.
But here is the pivot in Hare's argument. He calls this a blick. B-L-I-K. He says, it is not an assertion about the world. It is a way of looking at the world.
Exactly. So the explorer in the first story was trying to make a factual claim about a gardener. The paranoid Don isn't making a factual claim. He's revealing a filter.
A worldview.
Right. Hare argues that religious faith is a blick. It determines how you interpret every single piece of data you encounter. It explains the person's behavior and concern. It has meaning. Because it radically changes how the person lives, even if it's not verifiable in the positivist sense.
It's a really compelling idea.
Yeah.
But it seems a bit dangerous, doesn't it? If religion is just a flick, it means you can never really argue against it with facts. It's entirely subjective.
And that is the exact criticism people had. If it's just a flick, is it true or is it just a psychological quirk? That's where the third philosopher, Basil Mitchell, tries to find a middle ground.
With the story of the stranger.
Yes. This one is set in occupied France during the war.
A resistance fighter meets a mysterious stranger who tells him, I am on your side. Trust me.
Right. And the stranger provides help and resources. But sometimes the stranger is seen acting in ways that seem to actually help the enemy. His behavior is ambiguous.
So the resistance fighter has conflicting data. His friends start questioning him, asking if this guy is a double agent.
Precisely. And the fighter says, no, he is on our side. He acknowledges the ambiguous evidence. He sees the stranger helping the enemy. But he maintains his trust because of that initial encounter.
So this is fundamentally different from the blink. The fighter actually admits the evidence does count against his belief. He's not delusional. He's just choosing to trust despite the data.
Correct. Mitchell argues this is what religious faith is actually like. It is a factual claim, the stranger's on our side, that is open to future verification. The philosopher John Hick later called this eschatological verification.
Meaning verification at the end of time.
Right. You can't verify it now, but in principle, it will be verified eventually. So these three parables, the gardener, the paranoid Don, and the stranger, they basically blew the door open. They showed that factual language is much looser than the positivists thought.
It can express trust, or commitment, or worldview, not just raw empirical data.
Exactly.
Which leads us perfectly to the man who really formalized this idea that language is a toolbox, Ludwig Wittgenstein. Now, we have to distinguish here between early Wittgenstein and later Wittgenstein, right?
It's a crucial distinction. Early Wittgenstein was the darling of the positivists. But by 1953, with his book Philosophical Investigations, he completely pivoted. He started seeing language not as some logical calculus, but as a form of social behavior. He called it a form of life.
And the core analogy here is the toolbox.
Yes. Think of a carpenter's toolbox. You have a hammer, pliers, a saw, glue, nails, a ruler. A hammer is great for driving nails, but it is terrible for measuring length.
The positivists were basically saying, if it's not a ruler, if it doesn't measure facts, it's not a tool.
And Wittgenstein is saying, no, sometimes we need to hammer things. Sometimes we need to glue things. Words have diverse functions just like those tools.
He introduced the concept of language games to explain this. And he doesn't mean games like Trivial Fun, right? He means games as in rule-bound activities.
Right. Just as you can play many different games with a single deck of cards, poker, solitaire, building a house of cards, you can play many games with language. You can play giving orders, reporting events, guessing riddles, making jokes, cursing, or praying.
So asking, is this sentence empirically true? is just the wrong question if you're playing the game of joking or praying. You're applying the rules of chess to a game of poker.
Precisely. Wittgenstein believed that philosophical problems almost always arise when we confuse these games. We take a word from one game, like verification, and try to force it into another game where it doesn't belong at all.
And he saw philosophy's actual job as fixing this confusion.
Yes, he called it therapeutic. He famously said the goal of philosophy is to show the fly the way out of the fly bottle.
It's such a vivid, slightly gross image. We are the fly, buzzing around inside a glass bottle, confused by the invisible walls of language, just banging our heads against concepts we don't understand.
And his method isn't to give you new information or new scientific facts. It's to assemble reminders of how language actually works in everyday life to get you out of the trap.
Let's look at another figure in this rebellion who used this exact method to tackle the problem of the mind. Gilbert Ryle. He wrote The Concept of Mind and went after what is known as Cartesian dualism.
Dualism is the classic idea that the mind and the body are two completely separate, distinct entities. Ryle argued this entire problem was based on a category mistake.
He used a cricket analogy to explain this, which is very on brand for Oxford philosophy.
Very much so. He imagines a foreigner visiting a cricket match. The foreigner sees the batsman, the bowler, the wickets, and the fielders. And then he asks, but where is the team spirit?
As if team spirit is another player standing next to the wicketkeeper.
Right. The foreigner is looking for a physical object, but team spirit belongs to a completely different category. It's the way the team plays together, not a separate physical thing on the field.
And Ryle applies this directly to the mind.
He does. He says we treat mind and body as two separate things just because they are both nouns. But that linguistic quirk leads to the myth of the ghost in the machine.
The idea that there is a little spectral pilot inside our mechanical body pulling the levers, the ghost in the machine. That phrase has taken on such a life of its own in pop culture, but Ryle was using it as a mockery.
Oh, totally mocking it. He was attacking the idea of the soul as a thing. He proposed what's called linguistic behaviorism. He argued that mental language isn't describing a secret inner ghost at all. It's describing behaviors or dispositions.
So I say I am angry. I'm not reporting on a secret, invisible soul state.
No. According to Ryle, you are saying you have a disposition to yell, to turn red, or to slam a door. It's public behavior, not private theater.
That seems like it solves a lot of headaches regarding how a non-physical ghost could possibly push a physical button in the brain. But it also feels a bit hollow. Does it really account for the actual internal feeling of being angry?
That is the major criticism of Ryle. It seems to ignore the qualia, the internal subjective experience. But Ryle was more interested in dissolving the logical problem of how mind and matter interact. He thought dilemmas like free will versus determinism were false dilemmas caused by territory disputes between different uses of language.
Speaking of how we use language, let's bring in J.L. Austin. The source material notes he had a very dry sense of humor. He titled the book Sense and Sensibilia as a play on Jane Austen.
Austin was the one who really systematized all of this. He was obsessed with the nuances of ordinary speech. His big contribution was speech act theory. He argued that we don't just describe the world with words, we perform actions.
So saying something is doing something.
Exactly. He broke it down into three parts. First, the locutionary act. That's just the utterance itself, the physical act of saying the words. Then, the elocutionary act. What you do in saying it.
Can you give us a concrete example of that?
Sure. If I say, I promise to pay you back, I'm not just describing a state of mind. I am performing the act of promising. I am binding myself. Or if a judge says guilty, they aren't just describing the defendant. They are creating a legal reality. They are giving a verdict.
That makes sense. And the third part?
The perlocutionary act. That's what you achieve by saying it, like persuading someone, annoying someone, or stopping someone.
So if I yell stop at someone running toward a cliff, the locution is the actual word stop. The illocution is the order or the warning. And the perlocution is the fact that they actually freeze in their tracks.
You've got it.
Yeah.
Austin argued that philosophers had been entirely obsessed with statements that describe facts, and they had completely ignored these performatives.
He also used this extreme attention to detail to attack A.J. Ayer's sense data theory. This was the positivist idea that we don't actually see tables and chairs. We only see patches of color. Or sense data.
Right. Philosophers love to argue that because a stick looks bent in a glass of water, we can never really trust our senses. We are always trapped behind a veil of perception. Austin argued that this was ridiculous.
How so?
He said words like looks, seems, and appears are actually very subtle and distinct in everyday English.
We already know how to use them to navigate the world.
Exactly. When I say that stick looks bent, I am not reporting a fundamental failure of reality. I am reporting a known optical effect. We don't need to invent a whole new metaphysical category of sense data just because of a simple visual illusion. He basically said, look, ordinary language has been refined over centuries. It's actually much smarter than these artificial philosophical languages.
So bringing this all together, we started with the positive as saying, if it's not science, it's nonsense. And we ended up with this rich, complex view where language is a toolbox for living.
That is the massive shift. We moved from a highly reductionist view where truth was incredibly narrow to a world where language is understood as a social behavior used for promising, praying, trusting, and joking.
And this had a huge impact on religion and ethics, didn't it? The source material mentions that this loosening up of verification actually allowed for a resurgence in the philosophy of religion in the late 20th century.
It did. People like Alvin Plantinga and Nicholas Wolterstorff later walked right through the door that these ordinary language philosophers unlocked. Suddenly, you didn't have to prove God was a measurable physical object to talk about faith meaningfully in an academic setting.
You could analyze religious language as its own game or form of life without forcing it to be bad science.
Exactly. It validated that different domains of human life have different rules of meaning.
It really changes how you listen to people. Instead of just fact-checking every single sentence against the scientific standard, you have to stop and ask, what game are they playing? What are they trying to do with these words?
That is the key takeaway for anyone listening. Are they reporting a fact?
Huh?
Expressing a blick, making a promise. If you don't understand the game, you'll inevitably misinterpret the move.
It does make me wonder, though. Wittgenstein said philosophy is just assembling reminders to keep us from misusing language. It raises a pretty provocative question. Are we actually solving the world's deep problems, like the nature of existence or morality, or are we just learning how to talk about them without getting confused?
That is the ultimate question of this entire school of thought. But perhaps clearing up the confusion is the only real solution we have. If the fly gets out of the bottle, maybe that's enough.
Definitely something for you to mull over. Next time you're in a conversation, try to spot the language game being played. It might just save you an argument.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into ordinary language philosophy.
It was a pleasure.